Hello and welcome to Future Building. I'm Matthew Aitchison and I'm Professor at Monash University and CEO of Building 4.0 CRC. In this podcast, we take a broad look at buildings and building in contemporary society and what's coming down the pipeline in the future. We'll talk with invited guests and experts in the field, where we'll cover news and trends along with research and developments in the industry. Future Building is proudly sponsored by Building 4.0 CRC. As a show that's devoted to building innovation, I'm sure many listeners of this podcast would have heard of today's theme. It's often referred to as a kit of parts or a productized approach. Sometimes you might have heard it mentioned as MMC or modern methods of construction, and lesser so as prefab, modular, or offsite. But what distinguishes this kit of parts approach from both traditional building and the more commonly known volumetric modular, where buildings are transported in pre-finished modular blocks to be stacked on site, is that buildings are made up by parts and that these parts are not necessarily manufactured in one factory, but many. Now, this may seem like a small distinction, but being able to break a building down into parts and draw on a range of manufacturers to produce them is not a new idea in building, but it's one that's never really achieved full success, perhaps until now. So imagine if there was a place that all these manufacturers of building parts could put their products for sale. Imagine if all the relevant details, including size, standards, performance criteria, and other important information such as cost, were as embedded in these products on that site. Making a building could become as easy as shopping for your next bathroom refurb on IKEA's website. That would be pretty cool. No tenders, no shop drawings back and forth, no wait and see. A one-stop shop for all the parts needed to make a building. That is what Cope out of London is all about. In today's episode, I talk with co-founder of Cope, David Flynn, a company that he co-founded back in 2019. Cope has pulled all of this digital infrastructure together in one place, and in my view, it's the missing link that can accelerate the uptake of what I think is the next big thing in building innovation. Part marketplace, part design software, part specification tool. Cope makes the digital backend of this kit of parts approach easy for the entire value chain. Getting it right could mean achieving the scale effect and the frictionless interactions that will unleash the full force of manufacturing in building. Not surprisingly, David was trained as an architectural technologist and comes from the computational design part of the industry, having worked with important companies with deep experience in this space, such as Grimshaw Architects, where he was global head of BIM, and after which he founded Design Tech, a computational BIM consultancy based in London. Just a couple of highlights from our talk today were, I think, David's views on the trade-offs between standardization and flexibility in this new way of organizing the industry, and also his really honest views on culture of the industry and what the legacy of construction culture has been, and also his reflection on the use of AI and the future of the building industry, I think was particularly poignant for me. I really hope you enjoy our interview. I spoke with David from his home in London in July 2024. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Matthew.
It's great to hear your voice again. I know it's not been that long since we last met. Our audience won't know this, but David and I had the pleasure of meeting in London face-to-face in June earlier this year, and it's been quite some time. I haven't been able to wait to get back and have a longer conversation about many of the issues we discussed then, so really looking forward to getting into it, David.
Same here, absolutely. Yeah, it was good to see you a few months ago.
Excellent. So I always like to start with my guest's background. Now, you began in architectural technology, you got into BIM and through that into computational design. I wanted to ask you how that background prepared you to then launch a couple of startups and most recently, obviously, Cope.
No, absolutely. I suppose in a few ways, it probably helped me understand the need in the industry more so than anything else. Getting a feel for what was missing, what the tool sets out there did and didn't do, and probably hearing the cries of the design teams moaning about what wasn't available to them on a pretty regular basis. So It was really good opportunity to see what was needed and where maybe I could fit in with a couple of colleagues. I think on the technical front, probably it was an interesting one because my background never really made it towards computational design on my own. It was always the people that I was working alongside. On my end, it was always about the kind of gritty tools, the CAD tools and the BIM tools, and making sure that you're able to get the production aspect of what we do in it as this in this industry pretty well put together. But when it came to computation, that ended up being the people that I was surrounded with. And that really opened my eyes to the opportunity of saying, you know what, actually, let's pool our resources, let's pool our skills, let's maybe do this as a bit of a business.
That's great. And did that mean that other people that you worked with had some of those business skills, or did you acquire the business skills required to create your own startup?
Oh yeah, good question. It's an interesting one. Most of my friends are architects or technicians. So a lot of people that I went to university with are still close friends. And then obviously working through lots of big architectural offices, kind of collating a big group of architectural friends. And it's interesting how little business skills weave themselves into that. It's a fascinating one. There's probably a reason why architects tend to be at the bottom of the fee tree. There really isn't a lot of overlap there, and I do think it's probably it's a sad aspect of that industry where someone in that space who's a significant generalist, probably more of a generalist than anyone else in the design teams, tends to not have that one skill set that allows them to kind of hold their own. And then we struggle with the exact same problem. Like we really did. We really didn't understand what it looked like to put a company together, to put a team together, to negotiate fee, to send out invoices and ask people to pay you, and even just creating a culture within the team. All of that stuff was completely new to us. But I will say that we probably learned some of the aspects of creating a collaborative environment, knowing what you don't know, which I think is a strength of designers in general. My experience working in large offices like Grimshaw, you had an opportunity to basically see what you really didn't know yourself and lean into other people's skill sets. So it certainly created the right attitude, I think, for a business.
Yeah, that is a fascinating aspect of the startup world. And I guess, business in some degree makes autodidacts out of all of us. So I tend to agree with you. I mean, I happen to have an architectural background as well, and I think that kind of curiosity and the kind of can do that comes out of that design perspective has been really helpful for me in getting into business. But moving along a little bit, we obviously heard a little bit about COPE in the introduction, but I thought I'd like to give you, in your own words, a chance to explain what COPE is all about and what it is that you and the team are trying to do.
I think in a nutshell, what we're trying to do is we're trying to solve the technical challenges that a lot of the physical product designers are experiencing. There's been a bit of a drive in the industry to focus on offsite construction and all of the benefits that that gives you in relation to efficiencies and sustainability and kind of the repeatable aspects of construction. The problem that we found was that a lot of those companies, to really deliver on the vision that they had, needed to build a kind of a digital infrastructure around what they were doing physically. Which, you've spoken to a few people in this space. That is probably the most complex mix of challenges in our industry. To mix a physical and a digital version of the same product and be able to bring it to the industry is really, really challenging. And through our experience, we were focused on computational design, generative design. We worked with Autodesk for many years. We understood the design tools really well. And we just felt we were the right people to maybe have a crack at solving the digital aspect of this. So allowing the people who are in the factory floors, who are within the product design teams, to really do what they do best, but to not worry too much about the digital side of things. And that then led us down the path of creating COPE. Yeah, so actually, kind of, The story of Cope kind of began when we were invited to work with a volumetric modular company in the UK. And it was interesting because the dynamic that we had at the time was we were starting to do a lot of computation, a lot of automation, being able to produce drawings quickly, the kind of standard things that you would expect from that type of consultancy. But what we realized was that that company was really in need of a digital representation of what they were actually selling, and they were selling volumetric modules. So we focused on translating a low-level design file all the way through to fabrication. So we were able to automate all of the cut lists, we were able to automate the stacking, and we were automating the packing onto the trucks for the boarding. We were automating what was being sent to each station in the factory. And it was pretty successful in its own technical way. I think I had some challenges in relation to the way that people wanted to operate day to day. I think there was a little bit of resistance around it modifying people's kind of process, the physical process of moving material. But what it did do is it kind of lit a spark, and we basically decided as a team, what would this look like if it was for everyone? And what would we build if we were to do something like this for any product manufacturer in the offsite space? And that kind of led us to the eureka moment of let's build Cope and let's absolutely build one of the most complex pieces of software I've ever seen and really, really attack that challenge.
Excellent. And so is that sort of end-to-endness what separates you from others, or do you even have competitors in this space?
Yeah, it's a great question, Matthew. I think realistically, there are competitors of the status quo to a certain extent. You can do a lot of what you need to do with the design tools that are out there if you're willing to roll up your sleeves and you're willing to put some resources towards that challenge. Nothing's impossible with the technology we have today. You can make these things work, and our industry is full of very, very smart people. The brightest people who have decided to get into one of the most archaic industries. It's a funny scenario. And so what we tend to see for ourselves being a little bit different is that we have no direct connection to the physical product. We want to be able to view a configurator for every product. And so we take a slightly different approach, which is to say, why are you building things the way you're building them? Let's codify those rules. Let's codify those steps, the processes and attitudes and opinions that you have. Let's write them down. Let's turn them into code, and let's have your product act the way it actually would in the real world, but in a digital sense. So it's a little bit different, but I think realistically, if you looked at the market right now, there's some super, super, super cool teams out there who are doing basically the kind of infrastructure of being able to do that. But I don't know if there's too many people who've taken the attitude we have, which is, and today's a great example of that, of really just getting into the weeds of the challenge, like discussing the challenge, realizing that we got it a little bit wrong, adjusting, talking to more manufacturers and so on, and repeating that process.
I introduced someone else that you know, and I know you know them because we were all together in Australia recently. I interviewed Philip Erler from Gropius a few weeks back on this podcast. And interestingly, I didn't realize this at the time, but his company was also founded in 2019, just like Cope.
Oh, very nice.
And I wanted to ask you as well what I asked Philip, which is that what has kind of changed in the operating context of Cope since you began in 2019? I mean, it's been a really turbulent period. I'm just thinking about COVID, for example, and more recently, the kind of housing crisis. So, what's that been like for you, and what's loomed large on your horizon?
I think if you asked anybody who's had a young company in the last 5 years this question, I think one of the themes will be remote working, which is just this profound change. I come from architecture where if you're not seen to be working, you're not working. Like there's a culture there where, if you don't have two screens full of CAD and BIM and you're not moving your mouse at light speed, you are not doing anything. And to be honest, I'm probably a proponent of that. I think I definitely dragged some prejudice in to cope, that that was the way that things should be. And I realized really quickly that, you don't hire people into your team if you don't have a level of trust with that person. And that level of trust grows over time, and you have to believe in them, and you have to just accept the fact that, you're going to be a little bit distant from them. So I think the remote aspect of it has been absolutely profound. There was people in our team who I didn't meet for 6, 8 months. We hired them and I never met them, which is a very strange scenario. So I think that's one aspect of it. I think maybe one aspect of this that we struggled with particularly was that we are trying to build a the configurator of all configurators to a certain extent. And that means that being on a factory floor, being on a building site, being in the same location as a product is very, very useful to us, to see how that product interacts and works and behaves. And COVID really stopped us from doing that for a long, long time. And there's still restrictions in the way that you're able to get access to different teams around the world, because they tend to be remote too, and they tend to not have everyone co-located. So the remote aspect of it is significant. I think on the commercial side of things, we're in London, for anyone unsure. We have had a government here who spend money in very strange ways, and it's been very unpredictable. And so when it comes to the housing crisis, housing ministers were changing every 6 months. Infrastructure ministers were changing every 6 months, and we didn't have a particularly stable, look forward in relation to what was being built in the country. So when it came to investing, it was very, very difficult to do. So it's kind of led our company to focus a little bit away from the UK, and spend some time with yourself down in Australia and meet some of our colleagues down there, and to also spend a lot of time in the US.
Just on that context, is now that there is a new government in place after quite a long period of conservative rule, are you seeing that change? Have you changed the strategy of the business in anticipation of this?
No, we haven't really. I think one thing that we have realized about the kind of, the strategy that we've taken as a company overall has been that we're somewhat agnostic to sectors. So if there's a big push to do housing, it probably doesn't matter too much to us. The reality is that a lot of these building products go into lots of different building types. And so the drive within sectors tends to not have a huge impact on us. But what it is doing is it's probably giving us a little bit more of a focus to, let's say, engage in some of the innovation funding, to engage in some of the big frameworks that are within the UK. So for people unfamiliar, there's a methodology in the UK to deliver large infrastructural projects by essentially bringing a group of companies together, locking them in commercially to each other, and then they deliver aspects of that framework over time. For a small company like us, getting into them is very challenging, as you can imagine. There's a trust gap, which is absolutely fair. But we need to we're taking the punt now of saying, we're not a startup anymore. We're a bit more of a scale up. We've kind of proven our worth a little bit to some of our customers. We have some evidence of that now. So we want to engage in them. So it is a little bit different at the moment, Matthew.
Look, I'd like to swing the conversation a little bit into this kit of parts or productized approach that's that your company is focused on to some degree, and particularly around different conceptions of building innovation. I've had many guests on this podcast where we end up talking about, is it hardware or is it software, or is it hardware and software? You spoke to this a little bit before, but I would like to drill a little deeper, I guess, around what the challenges are facing a software company like yourself that interfaces with a hardware production industry that's very, very undigital, as far as I can see. So I might have that wrong, but if I don't, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, you absolutely have it right. I think I'll give you a kind of an anecdote on that front. As we've been developing Cope, we've been focused on different building product categories. So let's say we wanted to do a framed wall, and all the different types of framed walls, whether they be light gauge steel or timber, whether they be layered with boarding or not. Very, very much kind of grouping product types together. We build the technology to address them, and then we go out to market. What we realized was that the first one that we chose, which is SIPs, structured inset panels, a lot of the companies who are actually delivering SIPs into the market tend to get either scribbles. They get a PDF if they're very lucky. They tend not to get CAD. They definitely don't get 3D models. And our whole concept is built on 3D models. So it was a bit of a learning experience for us to say, you know what? You can build the coolest technology. You can build whatever you want. But if you're not responding to the day-to-day of your customer and the day-to-day experience of what they have to work through, we're wasting everyone's time. And it was a big adjustment for us. So we've really pivoted. We attacked that challenge. We said we'll handle that problem. We've partnered up with some unbelievably talented teams to be able to automatically convert 2D to 3D, to be able to address that challenge and then offer that within our service. So there's been an adjustment for us on that front. But to speak to the heart of the problem, I think there's companies out there that both of us are familiar with who do physical and digital. And if they have the skills and the patience and the gumption to do that, and it is probably the single hardest challenge in our industry, if they do, they have an advantage after a certain point where the understanding of the product and the understanding of the digital kind of merge, and they end up with something that's a little bit more symbiotic. One change here relates to a change here. They're able to really push their business forward at pace. I know, Philip, who's a colleague of both of ours at this point after our roadshow, really has that attitude. It's like if you can bring both of these together, you get significant advantage. The problem that we found is if you're only doing one, which is to your question, if you're only doing one of those two things, the challenges of the other side of it just get exponentially more difficult. A physical product team who are, gluing or stapling things together, and they're cutting and they're sawing and they've got a messy factory floor. Do they really understand the deep levels of coding that you have to build for a particular rule set for computational design? Like they don't, and they shouldn't have to. But the reverse of that is their problem, which is we can write that code and we can do some very cool things in software. But people kind of do things because they just do them. And we've learned the lesson of if you go into a product manufacturer and you say, why are you doing X? They'll just say, well, that's just because that's what Dave said to do. That's what we've been doing for 20 years and we don't really know why. But we know it works, and it works, and we have a viable business because of it, and that's what we're going to do. And that is a very, very fair answer. The thing is, you can't code that and you can't write that rule. So we struggle with that a little bit. So I do think that the core answer to that question is genuinely respect the things that you do not know about that process and lean in to the experts. Lean into the fact that these people have been doing this for decades and they have a deep respect for what they do. They have an understanding for what they do. And if you're going to build software for them, you need to match that and you need to step up to the plate and address that directly.
Well, one of the flip sides of the argument, though, that you're making is that yes, the difficulty is there, and as you say, can get exponential. But surely the scale argument is just as strong, David. I mean, if you are doing all of those things yourself, then you have to scale the hardware and the software at the same time. Whereas if I understand Cope correctly, you're effectively harnessing all of that manufacturing capability and pushing it through a centralized, online portal.
Yeah, spot on. I'll give you an example of where we really see that scalability from what we're doing and why the company's been able to get to where it is at the moment. If you are building a precast concrete floor, which is a very, 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 very typical product in our industry, very common. The reality is that within certain, restrictions, your concrete plank is going to be 90% the exact same as someone else's. In another region, in another country, there may be subtle differences in relation to your supply chain. There may be subtle differences in relation to the way that it's actually manufactured, But the reality is that product that's been craned into a site is very, very similar to another. And your special, kind of the special sauce of that business is you being able to manage cost effectively, to be able to deliver on time, to build the relationships that you do with your contractors and your subcontractors and with your clients. That's the special kind of business piece. But the reality is the product is very, very similar to others. And when we got into this process, we realized that if you code that 90% similarity, you're able to basically provide the basics of a configurator for everyone who builds that concrete plank. That is a very compelling sales pitch to an investor. If you're able to say, I'm not building a configurator for this concrete plank, I'm building it for all of them everywhere. And we're able to target all of those customers and we're able to provide value to them all very, very quickly. The problem is, and the challenge to us is, this is why, I've definitely found this to be probably the toughest maybe year and a half of my career, has been that 10% that's left for each of those products is difficult to extract, and it's difficult to have a deep understanding of why that's different. And there are subtle differences, and I think context is king. When you put things into a building, things change, so you've got to address that. You've got to address the design process. You've got to address what architects and engineers want. So there is that 10% there that's actually very, very difficult to solve. But I think we're in a position where the similarities of those products is really the selling point of what we're building.
Yeah. Look, before we get into the kind of how to productize the industry, we've touched on that a little bit, but we'll come back to that. I did just want to linger for 1 minute around the kind of business aspects that we touched on in the introduction. Where are you at in your journey, and what's it been like post-COVID out there raising funding and doing that kind of side of the business?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I'll avoid having a rant because you had to listen to my rant in London. But I'll do my best. But I do think there's a kind of a sickening aspect to raising money in our industry, which is that if we were in fintech, if we were in marketing, even if we were in social media, we'd be raising figures with an extra couple of zeros on. Because there's an understanding of those industries that just doesn't exist with construction. Even if we were to take the prop tech tag and not the contact tag, and we were to talk about actually, delivering property as opposed to delivering building materials, we'd probably have an easier time. But institutional money over the last 20, 30 years probably has figured out that construction is a bit of a mess, is an incredibly fragmented industry. But it is the core industry of civilization. Like it is the basis of everything that's around us. It isn't going anywhere. But it is a relatively risky environment to put money into, especially when you start to get into the type of technology that we're proposing here, which has a possibility of just simply not being possible to build. Like there's a it may be too big a challenge. So when it comes to money, it's been a little bit tricky for us. We've just so we're speaking in July, and we did our last raise in January. We were very fortunate to be able to bring on Autodesk as an investor, and Saint-Gobain for anyone in Europe or the US, which is the largest material supplier on the continent, and some institutional investors, and also investment from some customers, which has been really exciting for us. But it was difficult. It was really, really challenging. We had to prove certain things that I don't think you might have to prove in other industries. Being able to address a problem that people don't fully understand day to day has been challenging, because you can go to one of our customers and you can ask them what's Cope done for you. And I can I'll refer to a few of them, and they say very nice things, and they say very complex things about what the changes of their workflows are because of Cope. But the problem is that when the people they're telling that to don't really understand what they're saying. If you're allowing someone to make a financial transaction a millisecond faster with 10% more trust and security, it's a measurable thing, and you can put money in towards that. If you're saying that, a couple of people on your factory floor are going to be able to not have to be there anymore, let's say, or they may be able to move into the design team, and you may be able to automate XYZ process, it just becomes complex and it becomes tricky to sell in relation to investment. But with that said, we're in a good place. We ourselves and a few other companies that are similar to us in the space have secured the funding to be able to push on to the next phase. So we're going to be around for the next couple of years for sure. And hopefully that turns into the sales that we're chasing at the moment.
Well, congratulations on that, first and
Thank you, Matthew.
foremost. And I think your sentiments are well acknowledged and shared across many of the groups that I've spoken to over the years. It's a tough industry. It's a tough industry to innovate in, and then there is the added toughness of the funding around paths less trodden. And I think, each company like yourself, whether it's in construction tech, prop tech, or any other kind of tech, paves that way for everyone else. And I know that you see it that way. But congratulations again. I want to come to that question of the how. We all agree the industry needs to change. We and you and many others have sort of set our sights on this more productized approach to innovation in the industry. And at our conference that you spoke at, and it was very, very well received down here in Australia last year, you and I spoke quite a bit behind the scenes about the different approaches to this new kit of parts, productized approach to building. And I found that a very interesting conversation that I want to unpack again here today for our listeners, because it struck me that there's a dividing line, if you like, between groups in the industry. And the two camps, if I understood your comments correctly, might be seen as, on the one hand, this prescriptive standardization of the parts. And on the other side, let's call it a more flexible, parametric, and somewhat of a marketplace approach. There are some companies that we could name to both of those camps, but I think it's worth mentioning that Cope, at least in that conversation last year, really sits on that flexible, parametric marketplace approach. Can you just talk us through both sides of that debate, and maybe if share any other insights on that?
Absolutely. It's an interesting one. One of the big drivers, and I'll speak maybe to the UK in particular on this, has been that if you want to achieve standardization, the industrialization of construction, you need to design the interfaces. The interfaces is essentially everything in design. That's where all of your money goes, that's where all of your risk is, that's where all the design time is spent resolving. That they're everything. Two systems touching each other is where all the complexity lies. And the kind of I won't use terminology here that's denigrating anyone, because I really want to be supportive of everyone trying to make a difference here, because everyone who's trying is doing the right thing, irrelevant of them taking a path I wouldn't agree with. Any momentum forward is good momentum. But I think if you want to resolve the interfaces, you end up having to prescribe the systems and products very heavily. And there are many initiatives in the industry and companies in the industry who want to tell you, if you pick these 15, 20 products, we'll resolve the interfaces for you. And then they can just be used in any configuration. You can start to use them for lots of different scenarios. That's a pretty good idea. But first of all, that's not particularly democratic, or it doesn't really fit into the kind of merit-based approach that we want to take. It tends to say we're a closed shop. This is the Apple and this is the Google, and this is the system that you can live within. The commercial aspects of that are relatively rigid, and the risk profile of that is distributed in a way that might not necessarily be great for new entries, new companies coming into to using that system. So if you're to say, look, here's my floor system, wall system, roof system, I've resolved them for you, configure them, and here's a nice bit of software to do that. That's pretty cool. Like that is a great solution. But what we've seen is that people are very resistant to that. If firstly, if you're not procured within that design, secondly, who exactly resolves those junctions, and how exactly is risk assigned to those resolutions? It's a very, very complicated thing. And also, there's just an aspect of designers and clients, contractors, everyone involved, wanting to do things in a way that gets risk, distributes it as far away from them as they can, and then pushes it around for the rest of the project. And in a way, the kind of like, that very fluid design process that we all experience day to day at the moment is built exactly for that purpose. It's, I'm going to make a change. This change now pushes risk to you. You're going to resolve it, and you're going to push it to, let's say, a subcontractor, and it keeps on moving around. So that's option one. And that option we're seeing a lot. If you are a company who's able to own all of the parts of that kit, jackpot, because, and you've spoken to some of them yourself. If you're able to resolve them and hold that risk because you know it's a low risk, you have resolved it, that is a great outcome for that business. And some of those are out there who have the technology, like Gropius, who have the technology and the physical products. Cope is a little bit different. Cope's attitude is those interfaces are too complex to pre-resolve. They're context driven. They're related to different people, different use cases, different sites, different climates. They need to be resolved in a relatively traditional process. But every single other thing, everything about that building that isn't that interface, is very formulaic and very repeatable. So, as an example, if you were to think of let's say, an airport, you went to the arrivals hall and you think about the concrete floor. The perimeter of that floor is where the interfaces are, but all of the middle of that floor, all of that square footage, square meterage, doesn't have those problems. So what Cope is doing is it's resolving the constructability of all of that space. It's getting you all the way through that process, no matter what that product is, and then you can resolve those interfaces later on. So our attitude is keep risk exactly where it currently resides, which typically should be with a contractor. Let that process happen normally, and allow anyone to provide products into that system. A very, very open market. If you have a better product, you should be winning. Always have the best product, have the best price, have the best service. Go into those as an open shop, and don't have it too closed down.
Let me just play devil's advocate for a second. I think I'll start with the second method that you mentioned, the flexible parametric approach, the COPE approach. To me, the argument in favor of that second approach is, again, comes back to that issue of scaling. If you can meet those companies where they are, not where you want them to be, it strikes me that there are many more companies, certainly in this what we might term the early phase of the adoption of a more productized approach to building, or a kit of parts approach to building, whatever we want to call it. So you can find those companies where they are. Your system is flexible. It can adapt to those. And particularly in this early phase where everyone's effectively still figuring out which side of the road to drive on, right? That is a more accumulative, aggregating dynamic. Whereas I think the other side is a my way or the highway kind of approach. But I think if we put the ruler of time over both of those approaches, wouldn't in time all of those varied products want to tend towards something that's more similar? That has similar interfaces, for example. So I guess the question back to you here is this a temporal issue? Meaning we go through a phase of 5 or 10 years of everything being different and us needing to be flexible? Or do you see it as something more enduring than what I've just described?
Yeah, I think I see it more enduring. I think that there's just an innate need for all of us to be special, isn't there, and to be a little bit different. And That tends to be the things that we create. Who hasn't taken a recipe for a meal and ever so slightly tweaked it just for the sake of it? It's just what we do. And I do think there's probably an aspect of construction that, first of all, the race to improve is always going to make changes, and people will race and people will run towards that improvement at different speeds. So even if you set every single product in the construction industry to a baseline today, within a year, there are going to be differences, and within 2 years, there's going to be twice as much difference. I don't think we're able to have that kind of, that event horizon move forward with us, of that standardization. That our viewpoint is that standardization isn't possible. It's only possible within a closed garden. So you can create that stability, and then everyone moves forward as a unit. So if there's new materials coming through, there's new standards coming through, everyone adjusts together. But that's not really viable on a global scale or even on a national scale. So our attitude is that difference is inherent, that difference is actually to be respected. And what that difference does allow is the best products to the surface. And so what we're trying to do is build software that would say, keep your differences, enjoy them, sell them. Like that's a positive aspect of what you do. But our software will allow you to leverage the things that are still similar, that are still consistent. So it's a slightly different view of that, Matthew.
Yeah, no, I that resonates with me. I mean, I think I would obviously also draw a distinction that standardized parts doesn't necessarily mean standard buildings.
Absolutely.
But
Absolutely.
I also think, you make a very strong argument. Another question before we move on to other topics. It's often pitched, standardization, I should say, is often pitched as the thing that drives the scale. So if it's not the standardization that's going to drive that scale, what does drive it in your mind?
Well, if we're talking about scale in relation to let's say success in relation to productization, which I think is the kind of core focus for us. If you have, it's about having runway, I think, for a lot of these companies. The biggest issue that we found in the UK is that there are significant levels of innovation happening in offsite construction in the UK, probably more than anywhere in the world. But the problem that we have from a commercial and kind of political level is that you can't really predict what your order book is going to look like very far in advance. And these companies really struggle with that dynamic of, I have a really compelling product. I know it works. I know it's affordable. I know it works well in relation to the social value and its cost profile. But the problem is, we don't necessarily have the mechanism to guarantee that innovator a year or two of order. And they tend to fall over because of that. So one thing that we're really focused on is when you start to get into the large frameworks or large kind of programs, national programs, scale is inherent within those processes. So as an example, if you were to do a schools program, I know there's a couple of going on in Australia at the moment. There's a really compelling argument to be made there, that the fact that we have so many buildings of the same profile means that we can start to not make the products identical, but we can start to standardize the way that we're manufacturing them, procuring them, we're installing them, the way that they're being used, the way they're being specified. All of those different steps are being harmonized. And so we think that it's going to probably take a couple of large national programs to allow these smaller innovators to lock in their fabrication processes, to get the right staff and the right people in play, and to be able to understand how to deliver at scale. It's an interesting one. We'll talk about this maybe another time, but when you look at what's going on in Saudi, what went on in Dubai over the last 20 years, that's proper scale. And the only reason that those projects are interesting to a lot of people who are not from the region is because they see them as an opportunity to really change how things are done because of scale, because they're so significant, and they're so repeatable. But when it comes to national scale, I think when it comes to Australia, the UK, the US, you probably need to just find those innovators who've probably done business as usual well. They've got a good order book, and now they're ready to innovate. And they tend to be the people that we partner with. Those well-established businesses, they've got a good process, but now they want to do some innovation, as opposed to the startups who are, pushing the envelope every day, but don't have the order book in place.
Yeah, that's been a very big topic down here in Australia, around housing, building innovation and growing capability. It's been keyword pipeline,
Absolutely.
and getting governments to align around pipelines. And I think it's within that pipeline argument that this whole flexibility versus standardization debate is playing out. And obviously there's room for multiple positions here, and the larger that pipeline, perhaps the or the more walled the garden is, to use your metaphor, the more standardized things can be. But if we're in the, the Badlands or the Wild West of the current market, with a whole bunch of heterogeneous players who are all doing things their way, I completely take your point. David, I want to go on to a couple of the more vibey parts, let's call it, of our discussion. And I'm not sure whether this is just a vibe question I'm about to ask, or whether there is any hard data or kind of factual points that we could report on. But it is to pick up on a thread of a conversation that you and I had back in London in June, when we spoke about whether the UK was experiencing a retreat of sorts from MMC, or what's generally referred to as modern methods of construction. MMC, for listeners who are not familiar with that term, is really a term that's come out of the UK. The background that's necessary to understand here is that there were very substantial reports and policy written that were privileging, if you like, MMC within building production, and also many innovation and policy programs. Can you talk a little bit more about what you see going on in this space, and is there indeed a retreat underway?
Yeah, I think there is to a certain extent, but maybe not in the direction that we feel threatened by. I think we made a decision as a business, maybe just under 2 years ago, to not engage in volumetric modular companies. And obviously, that's where we started. That was the acorn that grew the oak, and that was a difficult decision to take, to turn away, certainly the great contacts that we had and the great experience that we had in that space. And the reason that we did it was because there was already starting to be some fault lines in the commercial viability of some of those businesses. See, like hundreds of millions of pounds spent on the infrastructure to be able to provide these modules, when the reality is that these modules really work, in a sense of whether they're stacked for mid and high rise. They tend to work really well for temporary. They tend to work really well when they're on the ground next to each other. But the British, housing stock tends to be terraced, two-story, with a pitched roof, long, long terraced housing. Very, very particular style of housing. And volumetric modular doesn't lend itself well to that. It's it's such a precision engineered piece of kit that's been shipped from the factory, and then the sites for these buildings, that they tend to be very rough. They tend to be not well prepped for that type of asset to be dropped on them. So we moved away from that a little bit, but the irony of that is that there's probably no more successful country in the world for doing mid and high rise volumetric modular. Like there's, I think most we always have the stat in the office. We joke about it all the time. We have a little list of all these really cool MMC projects, and most, I think, all but one of the tallest towers that are volumetric modular are in London, and there's a reason for that, and it's because the innovation's there. The companies are unbelievably talented and are very, very savvy in relation to the commercial aspects of that. But it's also the right building type. It's also the right type of construction. And it makes a lot of sense. Now, where we then landed because of that decision was that we went into the 2D space. So we wanted to be panelized. So panelized, whether that's on a floor or on a wall. And that space is healthy. It's going well. But I think all the oxygen in the room is sucked up by talking about volumetric. And when you see a news report about a company going under in, and it'll say MMC or, offsite company or whatever the terminology might be, it's always a volumetric modular company, like it 90% of the time. And it gives the rest of the companies who are doing the smaller pieces of the building a bit of a bad rep. So I think there's maybe a withdrawal from terminology for a start. There absolutely is on that front. I think people want to make prefabricated elements just business as usual, which is very exciting to us. That's a great attitude. I think making things tagged is just asking for people to, shoot at the target. And so there is a little bit of a withdrawal, I think, from promoting yourself in a way that basically puts your head above the parapet. But realistically, when you get into the way that, a lot of building assets are being built in the UK, it's all good. Things are going really well. Maybe not housing. I think housing's probably still a challenge. We have some incredibly entrenched housing developers in the UK who build houses at a pace that suits them, and they're not particularly interested in new technology. I think Australia's got a very similar problem, and they're just entrenched. That is what it is. But behind that, I think it's looking good. I think I'm pretty confident.
Let me just go back to that, because you rarely hear people talk about MMC in the US when I'm there. I don't know whether that's your experience, but in Australia, it's become the favoured word. It's all you can see governments around Australia at the moment harmonising around it. We use it as well because it's widely understood. But are you saying, if I hear you correctly, in the UK that is very much associated with the volumetric modular approach, where, to use your term, 3D components are being taken pre-finished to site and being stacked. Is that what MMC connotes in the UK?
It is to a certain extent, yeah. I think that'd be fair to say, mate. That is, if you look at any of the articles, you look at the magazines, I think that tends to be the piece that people promote. To be fair, it's easy to understand. When you see a module that's fully kitted out, it is incredibly cool. It's such a great piece of technology. People understand the fact that there's lots of things that have happened in advance. I think when you see a concrete plank or a SIP panel, people just be they just think it's a material. They don't necessarily see all of the work that happened in advance to be able to create that element. But when you see a volumetric module, it's incredibly obvious. So there is that aspect of it. I think there's a few other things at play though. We had this whole BIM process that happened in the UK. I was in the middle of all of that in my career, where we had the mandate for 2016 to get to what we call BIM level two. Which I won't get into it for any listeners today because it'll bore you to death. But it created a bit of a stigma and it created a bit of animosity towards people who were pushing terminology and pushing kind of preordained processes on top of the construction industry. There was a lot of pushback to it and. While it is business as usual now, that is how we operate typically in the UK, and things are going very well on that front. We're also 8 years later beyond where we actually hope to get to. So when MMC comes along, I do think there are, and I know there are parts of the industry who say, I really don't find this as something that's helpful to me. I already use wall panels, pre-assembled wall panels for my building. Why do I need to give it any sort of categorization? And why do I need to now start to think about the writing standards and processes and accreditations for those things that weren't there before? So there's a little bit of pushback on that front. And you guys are probably going to see something similar in Australia. But what I will say is the attitude of it being business as usual is the right attitude. Like that's make it as normal as you can. I got a question from my dad once, and the second he asked me, I was like, oh God, he saw right through my nonsense, right? I was showing him hope. I was showing him hope, and I was trying to explain to him what offsite construction was and industrializing construction and prefab and MMC, all of that. And he pointed at a door, and he was like, well, isn't that one? Like, that was made in a factory, and someone shipped that finished to a site. Yeah, you're right. And it is, a window is MMC, a door is MMC, most plant is MMC, kitchens, like the vast majority of buildings are. And so therefore, why do we need to see it differently? Why can't we just accept that that's how we build? So yeah, a bit of an interesting moment for me to learn from.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the terminology, I think to some degree, David, we've just adopted whatever seems to be the terminology of the minute, because I'm kind of become, quite clear in our group at least, that it's more about being able to communicate and get things going than it is about lexical accuracy. And your dad's right. The skeptics are right, but also the people who are writing, new policies to try to get this new way of building up and running are also right. So I feel like we're in for a kind of brackish period until some of this terminological stuff settles down. But I think that's a really interesting point. The other kind of cultural question that I wanted to ask was again stemmed from a conversation we had where and this is a building thing, this is an industry thing, where you were expressing some frustrations with a part of the industry where, and we've all done it, we all go on the stage and people don't really say what they think, and at the end of a great session they'll say, oh, we all want to work together, and then they never do. Do we need to be stuck in that cycle, or do you see another way of operating in the industry?
Yeah, it's the kind of the centerpiece frustration, isn't it? It's so when I spoke to you about that was stemming from a particular event that I attended. Really enjoyable event. Probably the smartest bunch of people I've ever been in a room with, and it was quite intimidating. Some of the presentations that were shown, it was very exciting. And near the end of that session, there was a panel that I happened to be on, and I looked around the room. And I was asked probably the wrong question at the wrong time, which was, what's next? Or are we just shouting into the void? And my answer, which is the same answer I'll give you now, is if I'm in a room with very smart people who all have the challenges that I'm trying to solve, first of all, why have I never met you before? And second of all, why will I never see you again? It's and I think I know the answer to that. I think the if I'm to be very honest and kind of introspective about this, I think it's probably because we're no better than construction as it currently is. There's a tech world growing at the moment with lots of amazing work being done, lots of startups, lots of interesting contractors, lots of interesting clients, and. But we're taking through some of the old attitudes on commercial aspects of this that we are railing against. Am I going to give some of the code of what we've built to someone who's building a really cool tool that might actually support us in the future? Like, probably not. I really wish I could. I wish I had a better attitude. But I've been indoctrinated in the idea of risk and the idea of. Commercial viability and the idea of uniqueness, and it's a really difficult thing to shake. It's our religion, it's how we all behave. And I wish we lived in a world where I could say, okay, I need a site feasibility tool, I need a manufacturing automation tool, and I probably need connection to a really good ERP. Okay, let's go find a startup in those spaces, and I could name them all now. Let's go and partner, and let's become a big beast of a solution, and let's actually go out and target the market together. I wish we could do it, but I just don't. I'm slightly pessimistic about this, Matthew. Like it's difficult, and I really wish we could get there. So you have that aspect of it with the startups and the commercial aspects of that. You also have the academic aspect of this, which is pleading with us to solve this because we know what the problems are and we know what the solutions are. They're written down. Like they're all there. They're all there for people to see. It's the academic side of it is probably the piece that could hopefully bring everyone together and say, look, we've got maybe some grant funding for this particular thing. We're going to support you working with these companies and we're going to bring together a single solution. But it takes time to get that moving, and it's a lot of there's a lot of pressure on everyone involved. So to come back to the core question, I rail against it and I get frustrated with the fact that we don't collaborate the way that we should, but I'm probably no better than anyone else. And I wish that we could be better, and I wish that we could be more open and more generous and more collaborative. But the reality of the commercial pressures that everyone feels within this industry are so profound, and it is such a risk-heavy environment that it is very difficult to break that cycle. And
Yeah.
that there's not an answer there,
Well,
Matthew,
look,
but
I think that's, no, that is an answer. And I think it's a very honest answer. I mean, it's certainly a lot more honest than saying, we're all going to go out of the room and work together. And, pretending we're taking down someone's phone number. So I think honesty is where we need to start. And you're right, the culture needs to change and we need to work on it. I am moving a little bit closer now to wrapping up, I guess. I would move to the little lightning questions at the end of the podcast here, David. And I guess the question that I want to start with and get you kind of quicker response from, we'll move through these pretty quickly. What do you think we should focus on more in building, and what do you think is not getting enough attention? We've spoken about a range of different areas. I mean, you just listed off three different types of sub areas where different companies that you're aware of are working. Like, what's an area where you think there could be more attention applied?
I think one big thing is addressing the design management layer of what we do. That there's definitely there's a layer of interaction within construction that basically says, "Hi client, here's the thing that you want to achieve. I'm going to assemble your team for you." And through that assembly, there tends to be a shifting of the commercials, shifting of risk, and also bringing in companies that they're familiar with. So any of these large construction management firms that are global, they tend to be the gatekeepers, and we work with lots of them, and we're very friendly with them. But the reality is, if you want to make this a more democratic, marketplace for people to provide products and services, you need to really address that layer. So I think the next phase of this is probably for some of the companies at the long tail of construction to really start to group together and to start to share some of their knowledge, leading into what my previous answer, but probably more so around the products and actually not necessarily on the tech end. If you have a really great compelling floor system and someone is doing a really interesting wall system, get that certified, get the things that you need to do for those two things to work together, and then push that out into the market. So a little bit more collaboration on that long tail is definitely something that we would encourage and we'd hope to see.
And then my final question, a very common question to people who've listened to the podcast before, it's the crystal ball question. And it's about, what do you think we'll see coming down the pipeline? What do you think is going to change in the industry in the next 5 to 10 years? What is your prediction?
I think at the moment it's like this is going to sound naff because everyone's talking about it, but I think with the AI side of things, and I'm always a bit hesitant to talk about this. It is our web address, I appreciate that, but we don't actually do any AI. What we do is we do complex algorithmic solves. We don't do generative AI. But what I do think is going to happen in the next few years is that at the moment the learning to be able to actually interact with construction is really, really difficult. I find it really funny that there's initiatives out there at the moment to train models to automate drawings when we've spent the last 20 years saying how bad drawings are. Like Why would you train it on the wrong thing? But looking at the tech space right now, with the digital twin initiatives and the way that we're starting to marry up the physical and the digital in a really cohesive way, lots of different companies are doing this. Lots of buildings have very, very robust digital versions. That data set is improving exponentially, and it's 3D, it's interactive, it's live, it's the metadata is robust. That data set is growing, and the technology for AI is tracking along with that. And I do think we're going to get to a point, and it's certainly part of our strategy, that the predictive nature of construction is going to start to kick in. So at the moment, as an example, Matthew, you would go on Cope Market and you'd basically say, look, I'm looking for a concrete floor system. Where we're headed as a business is, no, I'm just going to upload my design, and I want the software to suggest what an optimal outcome would be for different systems of the building. Have they been tested together? Are they affordable? Are they local? What's the sustainability credentials, et cetera? And really starting to utilize that machine learning to be able to suggest things as opposed to automating outputs. I think it's more about helping resolve some of the design issues faster. So I think that's a big thing that's coming up, and very excited to be part of that.
Excellent. Well, on that note, David, I would say thank you so much for your time today. I always have enjoyed talking with you. Every time we've got a minute, we squirrel away in a taxi or in a corner
For sure.
and talk about all things innovation. For our listeners, notes and references will be added online to the show as usual. Thanks for listening, and thanks once again, David, for your time today.
Thank you, Matthew. Appreciate it.